Today is Wednesday, May 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What challenges faced the Commonwealth during the pandemic?
One of the terrible things that we're facing, and it's an intersection with the coronavirus pandemic, is the climate crisis.
Plus an update after a wave of attacks in Afghanistan.
The death toll from the attack on the maternity hospital has risen to at least 24.
And we meet the winner of the Brunel International African Poetry Prize. Those stories and more are next. With nearly 300,000 deaths attributed to the novel coronavirus, the number of cases continues to climb, approaching 4.3 million, according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. In Asia, New Zealand has reported no new cases of the coronavirus for the second day in a row, and the fourth day in more than a week. Director General of Health Ashley Bloomfield said it was encouraging news as the country prepares to ease many of its lockdown restrictions.
As we prepare for level two tomorrow, the sense of anticipation is both palpable and understandable. We're looking forward to re-establishing some of the routines and rhythms of our near normal lives. In level two, it's vital we do continue to model the personal behaviours that are going to keep COVID-19 out of New Zealand and out of our communities.
Elsewhere, Thailand reported no new confirmed cases of the coronavirus for the first time in more than 2 months. And South Korea said it has no more immediate plans to return to strict social distancing rules after a spike in cases. Authorities in the Chinese city where the coronavirus pandemic began say orders have been issued to test all 11 million residents for the virus after a handful of fresh infections were found in the city. For further updates on the COVID-19 pandemic, visit voanews.com. U.S. lawmakers heard about the nation's response to the COVID-19 pandemic from the nation's top health officials on Tuesday, a panel that was moved online after concerns the White House is becoming a hotspot for the virus. More than 2 months into stay-at-home orders, lawmakers are considering yet another massive aid package to address the economic and public health crisis and to get the country running again. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
As states around the nation begin to relax stay-at-home restrictions, lawmakers get a warning about the costs of failing to wait for a decrease in fatalities.
If some areas, cities, states, or what have you, jump over those various checkpoints and prematurely open up without having the capability of being able to respond effectively and efficiently, my concern is that we will start to see little spikes that might turn into outbreaks.
Even as protests spring up around the country, calling for an end to restrictions, U.S. senators and health experts had to participate remotely because of possible exposure to the virus. And while Democrats wore masks, some Republicans went without, a sign of the increasingly political debate over how to handle the pandemic.
Staying at home indefinitely is not the solution to this pandemic. There is not enough money available to help all those hurt by a closed economy. All roads back to work and back to school lead through testing, tracking, isolation, treatment, and vaccines.
U.S. President Donald Trump says the U.S. has now caught up with other nations.
We prevailed on testing.
Lawmakers receiving more detail on exactly what that capability will be.
So by September, taking every aspect of development, authorization, manufacturing, and supply chain into consideration, we project that our nation will be capable of performing at least 40 to 50 million tests per month.
Even as the U.S. economy gets up and running, the damage will be difficult to contain. Unemployment numbers are the worst in almost 100 years. But Senate Republicans are urging caution before Congress approves another round of aid.
We're taking a look at what we've already done. We've added about $3 trillion to the national debt and assessing the effectiveness of that before deciding to go forward.
Democrats say another massive infusion of cash is needed to help essential workers and to restart the U.S. economy.
We must think big for the people now, because if we don't, it will cost more in lives and livelihood later. Not acting is the most expensive course.
Their $3 trillion proposal set to pass the House later this week has no chance of clearing the Republican majority U.S. Senate. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
54 nations around the world, most of which are former territories of the British Empire, are members of the Commonwealth of Nations. Patricia Scotland is the organization's Secretary General. I spoke with her via Skype about the challenges member nations are facing during the COVID-19 pandemic and what's being done to address their needs.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most important things is that we do have those 54 countries. And as you know, we have rich ones, we have poor ones, we have big ones, we have small ones, and we have everything in between. And because this pandemic is something that none of us have seen before, and there was a real ignorance as to how we should deal with it, it's meant that we've had different iterations, that some of our countries who have experienced it first and maybe have not known quite how to respond effectively, we've learnt from what they did and what they failed to do. And in sharing all of that knowledge, all of that understanding, we have been better able to support those who are in the second wave to do earlier the sort of things that will really make the difference.
You brought about this is that there are different circumstances among the 54 countries, yeah. And there are some rich ones, there are some poor ones. So how is the knowledge being transmitted, and what steps and in what ways is the Commonwealth actively helping, one another out?
Well, immediately this happened and we had to go in lockdown. I came home, but we decided that we would put everything up online and we would create a virtual Corona Resource Center. That resource center was able to pool all the information we already had. So, for example, we had in 2018 created an innovation hub. In that innovation hub, we had the data in relation to all the sustainable development goals. So we had an understanding from the data that we'd got from the World Bank, from the IMF, from the UN and other multilateral organizations, together with the information that we had ourselves accrued over the years. So we really understood the position of each of our countries.
What specific challenges have you faced in addressing this, and how have you overcome them?
Well, one of the terrible things that we're facing, and it's an intersection with the coronavirus pandemic, is the climate crisis. Because in the Pacific, we have just seen the whole area hit by the storms that's been caused by Cyclone Harold. So you have cut off from the rest of the community. Things aren't flying in. Yet you have to have social distancing at a time when you're dealing with a crisis. So that's one of the issues. How do you keep that connectivity going?
You're coming on this with some climate change issues, the locusts, the cyclones, and so forth. The challenges of getting materials to and from locations in this age of physical distancing. And as I have spoken to many health professionals, they say the key is testing. And you spoke about some of the innovative tests that are coming up from the Commonwealth countries. So how do you get materials, testing, PPE, the personal protective equipment, where there is none, from locations that there are none, and maintain that continuity of connectivity, given the disparate nature of some of the infrastructure on the communication side?
Well, what we are doing is by using the Coronavirus Center and all of our contacts, the multiplicity of networks within networks, that we are pushing the information through those different ventricles to make sure that the information is getting to where it needs. And this working out how innovatively we can move forward and looking at what joins us has really been successful.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. Now, if you'd like to hear the entire conversation and see it as well, you can follow us on Twitter. We're @VOA_IE, and I've put the link to the conversation there. We're also going to put it up on our VOA Africa YouTube page. More than 80,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, but through it all, healthcare workers have worked around the clock to stem the tide, usually at great risk to themselves. In the second part of our series of personal interviews with frontline workers, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Dr. Rishi Ratan, a critical care physician and trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, Florida, about the personal and professional challenges the pandemic poses for him.
We're at one of the busiest trauma centers in the country, so we're used to a busy workload, but the psychological effects have been very worrying. And coming to work is very much kind of like steeling yourself for battle. It's trying to get your head in order, trying to focus, trying to think about your team. It's almost like maybe also going through a pilot's checklist, thinking, okay, what is my plan if this happens? What is my plan if somebody with a gunshot wound to the chest comes in and spraying respiratory secretions and potentially virus all over the place, but is bleeding to death? Who am I going to send into battle, or who is going to join me in battle and put themselves at risk? And then the process of putting on our protective equipment and taking it off takes many, many minutes. Our trauma patients sometimes only have seconds to minutes to live. And so we sit outside knowing that we have the opportunity to save this patient's life, but that if we rush too fast to get on our protective equipment, we may expose ourselves. So there are very unique aspects to managing this pandemic that affects the way that we treat patients and affects the way that we interact with our team.
Give me an example of a once typical procedure that you performed that you might think about differently during the COVID era.
Well, normally when someone's heart stops in the ICU, we do CPR. What we do know is that the act of CPR is an extremely high-risk procedure for the team. What we're doing to the chest when we push on the chest to try to restart the heart, what the lungs feel is the equivalent of a cough, and a cough is how COVID is spread. So when a patient dies, sort of boils down to trying to choose whose life I'm trying to save. And it's a very unusual position, I think, for doctors to be in these days.
Decisions like that must be so wrenching.
Extremely, absolutely. And in addition, we know that part of the heart wrench of patients who have COVID is that they're alone in the hospital. Obviously, the nurses are at the bedside, and most nurses provide excellent comfort and bedside care. The doctors, we try to be there as well as much as we can, but it's different than having a family member at the bedside holding your hand, hearing their voice, and hearing them tell you that they love you. So a lot of those patients, I'm sure, feel very, very alone, as much as we try to do to prevent that. It goes against what we've been trained to do.
It must be especially difficult when you see your colleagues come down with the COVID-19. That's not too unusual these days.
It's very hard to be really close to these colleagues and see all the things they've done and sacrifices they've made to help their patients now fall ill and be right next to their patients on life support, on a breathing machine, paralyzed. It really hurts. You think about their families or their children that you've met and that they're at home scared without their parent. And then you realize that they got sick doing the same thing that you're doing. And you're wondering, will I get sick too? Will I be next to them on a breathing machine? Will I not be able to say goodbye to my family? Will I die alone? And it's hard to keep those thoughts out of your head. Did I do something today that's going to make me infected, that's going to have me end up being a patient in the ICU?
It must be so scary and disempowering to realize that your ability to help in so many cases is so limited, at least at this point.
Absolutely. Some of us are seeing more death in a shift than we've ever seen before in our lives. And so much of what we're telling each other is that we are not failures. This is not our fault that these patients are dying, that it's the disease's fault. You know, we are doing the best we can. But in addition, we know that our ability to manage our life is being wrested away from us by something that we don't fully understand. And all of us are scared. But I think that the larger disappointment for me and for many healthcare providers is feeling failed by our governments. But the other side of that coin has been the faith that's been restored in our communities. And to see how the people around us are coming together and crowdsourcing to support each other in the vacuum that our lack of leadership has left.
Dr. Rishi Ratan is a critical care physician and trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital. And still to come up in the program.
I try to write about home. I write about trauma and communication and miscommunication. I try to write about things that I feel very strongly every day, and I try to do it in a way that is exciting.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many consider the smartphone a technological wonder. With it, you can communicate with family and friends, as well as listen to music, check the weather or latest news, and with built-in GPS, keep yourself from getting lost. What many would consider a good smartphone feature is a way for it to help keep yourself healthy. While most smartphone manufacturers are concerned with regulatory issues a feature like this would bring, scientists at the University of Cincinnati have developed a small phone add-on medical system that would be able to monitor and detect a number of health conditions. The scientists say that with just a single drop of blood or saliva on a custom lab chip, the device can diagnose infectious diseases or countless other health conditions. After gathering diagnostic data, the device then automatically transmits the information to a doctor. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Militants stormed a maternity hospital in the western part of Kabul Tuesday, setting off an hours-long shootout with the police. The violence could further undermine the peace process in the wake of a deal signed between the United States and the Taliban in February. Earlier today, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad for the latest details via WhatsApp.
Yes, what we understand from officials in Kabul today is that the death toll from the attack on the maternity hospital has risen to at least 24, and almost 15 are women. And we also know that two newborn babies were also among the fatalities. So that was quite a devastating attack on the hospital, and that is what is being widely condemned inside the country and internationally. But we still don't have any claims of responsibility, and we know that the Taliban has denied its involvement. And the overall death toll from the two attacks, the other one was in eastern Afghanistan, in Nangarhar province, has risen to at least 51, whereas 115 people were injured. But as we know that instantly, President Ashraf Ghani announced that he was ordering Afghan security forces to go on offensive operations against the Taliban and other terrorist networks.
Speaking of those efforts, the Taliban has now responded to Ashraf Ghani's call for its offensive measures. So what can you tell us about the Taliban's response?
Well, it is very interesting that for the first time, we have seen a serious condemnation from the Taliban of any terrorist attack or any act of violence in Afghanistan, in which they just distanced themselves from the attacks, and they said the Taliban has never targeted civilian installations in the country, particularly hospitals. But at the same time, and in the same statement, the Taliban not only blamed the Afghan government for creating unnecessary tensions at a time when peace efforts are underway in the country, and they were really angry, sort of angry in their statement at this announcement by President Ashraf Ghani that he was ordering his security forces to go on offensive operations against the Taliban, because, you know, we know that the Taliban has been conducting battlefield attacks for the last few weeks, and they are apparently having an upper hand. So they just have threatened that if these offensive operations begin or they actually start targeting Taliban positions, they will further intensify their activities.
That was VOA's Ayaz Gul. Lesotho's Prime Minister Thomas Tabane will resign by May 22nd, according to a spokesman, adding that he knew nothing of an AFP report that the Prime Minister would hand in his resignation to the King Wednesday. Tabane's departure would resolve a political crisis that upended late last year and end a career marked by exile, political feuding, intrigue, and strains with the military. Tabane has been mired in a political and legal crisis stemming from the murder of his estranged wife in 2017. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Israel for meetings with Benjamin Netanyahu and the Prime Minister's new governing partner, Benny Gantz, to discuss Iran, the coronavirus, and Israel's possible annexation of parts of the West Bank. Egyptian poet Rabah Ashri, based in Chicago, Illinois, won this year's Brunel International African Poetry Prize of 3,000 British pounds, which is just under $3,700 U.S. dollars. The competition judges said she won the prize, competing with more than 1,000 other entries because of her challenging words about exile, the diaspora, and living between Arabic and English languages. VOA's Mohammed El Shenawi had the opportunity to speak with her.
I try to write about home. I write about trauma and communication and miscommunication. I try to write about things that I feel very strongly every day. And I try to do it in a way that is exciting. And I feel that my work has been recognized as such by the Brunel International African Poetry Prize.
How did your family life combining two cultures impact your poems?
I write about my family a lot, actually. I write about my mom and my sisters a lot. Growing up, my sisters and I learned how to speak English with each other so that our parents, who at the time didn't speak English, wouldn't understand what we said to each other. So we used the language as an excuse to have conversations in secret. So I have incorporated Arabic into my writing the way my sisters and I used it in conversations with our parents. And my family life has impacted my writing a lot. Again, like I said, a lot of my writing is about family and about home. So growing up between cultures just made me feel like the natural second step of that would be to combine Arabic and English together and create a poetry around both languages.
Your work was published in 2018 by Always Review. Did that help you toward participating in Brunel Poetry Competition?
Yes, the OA Review provided a wonderful platform for my writing to reach a new audience. And with the support of the poetry scene in Chicago and my graduate program at School of the Art Institute of Chicago, I gathered the confidence to submit my work to the Brunel International African Poetry Prize. And it was through the encouragement and the confidence that other people put in my work that I felt confidence too.
How would this poetry prize affect your future journey with poetry?
This prize has really felt very affirmative. It feels like my work has been heard and understood and that I found an audience for it. And with this recognition and this approval, so to speak, I feel a lot more confident in my writing moving forward, knowing that I have readers that I can count on and people that would be honest to me about my work.
Can you offer our audience a taste of your poetry?
Yes, I can read you a poem. This poem is called The Kia Karens. It's my sister's car. We argue about the black car absorbing heat. We let it stall on the corners of highways, hovering over the gray seats, thighs sticky, head bounding, back aching. Har. The radio kills the battery, so we give up the music, whistle to each other instead. Four girls in a broken car where danger wrapped in metal. Hamoud. We roll down the windows, paint the heat waves, chart its consequences. The trunk a costume closet, we undress. Mishma'ula, the pavement burns like a fever. We say this car's a betrayal. A home? A coffin? We ignore the PSAs about deadly heat strokes, parched like it's Ramadan. No one wants the sun-boiled water, the day-old Mountain Dew. Imtihan al-Sal, we're all thinking about cold showers, daydreaming about blue pools plunging underwater, ready to rinse off the city, angry and persistent in the summer. Yalla Bina. We drive to the mall, bury ourselves in its air-conditioned belly, past the hot breath of bloated parking lots.
Rabah Ashri won this year's Brunel International African Poetry Prize. She was speaking to our own Mohammed El Shenawi. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your computer, or any other device to voanews.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a wonderful Wednesday.